It does, he said. Are you still fishing? Yep. You want a job? Nope. Clayton shook the ice in his glass. You're a funny son of a bitch, he said. Sutray stood looking out across the fields behind the house toward the mountains. He raised his glass and drained it. Sit down, said Clayton, patting the arm of the other chair. Sutray propped one foot in the seat of the chair and rested his elbow on his knee. A cool breeze swung the kettled creepers hung from the porch joists. I believe it's fixing to cloud up and rain, Clayton said. Paper said it was supposed to. How'd you come out?
I just walked.
Where from? You didn't walk out from town, did you?
Well, I cut across from the river. I didn't have anything else to do.
I'll give you a ride back this evening, any time you get ready.
That's all right, Sutry said. Aunt Martha came from the kitchen with a fresh pitcher of tea.
You'll stay and take supper with us, won't you?
I better get on back. The old lady filled his empty glass.
Why, Buddy, she said, you stay and eat with us.
Thank you, but I better not.
Hell, just stay with us. You don't have anything to do.
The old lady bent and poured Clayton's half-filled glass full. He sat looking down at it.
God damn, he said.
He pitched it out across the grass.
Why, Clayton?
Clayton rose and went into the house muttering to himself.
Buddy, I do wish you'd eat with us.
I appreciate it, Aunt Martha, but I need to get back.
Let me bring you another piece of cake.
No, thank you, really. She came no higher than his shoulder. He almost reached down to touch her. Clayton called to him from the door.
You sure you couldn't use a drink?
Sutry shook his head. Clayton came out with his drink, one hand in his hip pocket. They stood there in the shade, the three of them. Sutry drained his glass and handed it to the woman. I've got to go, he said. They followed him into the kitchen and through the house. The aunt would have taken his elbow, save that her hands were full. She set the glass and pitcher hastily on the table and caught him up. Sutry turned and was surprised to hear her talking of the weather.
You let Clayton take you, she said. There will come a storm this evening long before you get back to town.
I won't melt, he said. He got out the door. Clayton was looking past the top of her head.
Take care, bud.
Buddy, you come see us, you hear?
He went on down the path into the road. He turned and raised one hand. The old lady waved timidly with just her fingers, and Clayton saluted with his glass. It was much cooler, and the wind was rising. Coils of dust rose in the road and spun off like smoke, and the sky to the west lay banked in a discolored mass of thunderheads. When he reached the highway, large drops of rain were falling. They made hot slapping sounds on the macadam. He could see the rain coming across the fields where the darkly overtaken blooms buckled and dipped. He pocketed his hands and slumped, and country-looking, he went down the edge of the black highway in the advancing downpour. Before he had gone far, an old Hudson pulled alongside him and sat there rocking and smoking and chattering while a man leaned across and lowered the glass just enough to let his voice out.
Hop in, old buddy. I hate to get in your car wet as I am. Can't hurt this old car.
Sutry climbed in, and they pulled away. He watched the steamy green landscape fade beyond the dance of water on the hood.
Boy, it's come a clodbuster, ain't it?
The man said. It is that. The man was leaning over the wheel to see. He nodded toward the dashboard where the radio was glowing.
Listen at that there, he said.
Sutry inclined one ear. A dim voice in the dashboard had a story to tell.
Well, he come down from there, and he said, see airy rain cloud up there? And he said, nary one. And he said, better go on up there and look again. And he went on up there, neighbors, and he come back down again, and he asked him again, said, did he see airy sign of a rain cloud? And he told him no. Said he'd not saw sign one. And he said, well, better go on up there one more time. And he done it. Went up there, and directly he come down again, and he asked him, said, is the airy rain cloud up there now? And he said, yes. Said, there's one up there about the size of your hat. And he said, Well, boy, you better get off the mountain, 'cause it's a fixin' to rain.
The driver smiled. He can lay it down, can't he? Sutry nodded.
I like to hear old Jay Basil. He's all the time saying, "Ain't that right, Mrs. Moe?" Old deep voice, and she'll say, "That's right, Mr. Moe." You like to hear him?
He's all right, Sutry said. Small birds were crossing the road in the windy sheets of rain. Going up a grade, the wipers died, and the glass peened over with rainwater. Sutry could not see out. Beyond radio and exhaust and valve chatter, he could hear thunder rumbling away over the bewept hills. They topped the hill, and the glass cleared in a slow arc. Around a curve, and Sutry pointed. "I get out here," he said. The man looked.
"Where?"
he said. "Here. Anywhere along here."
"You're not going to town?"
"No, just right here." The driver looked about, and he looked at Sutry.
"There ain't nothing here," he said.
"Just anywhere along here," Sutry said. "This is where I get out." The driver pulled up along the graveled shoulder and stopped. He watched Sutry. Sutry climbed out into the downpour. "I sure thank you," Sutry said.
"You welcome,"
the man said. Sutry banged the door shut and stood back. The car moved out onto the highway. Through the runneled glass, he could see the man's face turn again, as if to fix him there. Sutry crossed the road in the rain and blew motor smoke and descended an embankment into the fields. He went cross-country among easy hills and sometime pasture land, through a copse of dark cedars where the ground was almost dry, down a long and narrow limestone draw where a small flat cactus clung to the south walls, and the rain swept grayly across the ledges and swirled away before him. He came out on the bluff and went on up the hill toward the house. Came through the weeds upon a walkway of herringboned brick all but overgrown. Past cracked urns, bedight with concrete flora, broad steps, tall fluted columns with their shattered paint. The immense and stark facade seemed to recoil before his footfalls. As he entered the foyer, three young boys dropped like stricken bats from a balcony above the main reception room to his right, and lit soundless on the dusty floor and passed out through a window in the opposite wall. A chandelier lay burst in the floor. He stepped around it and ascended the left-hand stairway, slowly curving into the dusky upper chambers, keeping to the wall because, save random jagged spindles, the balustrade was gone. At the top of the stairs stood newel and finial intact, and solitary like a rococo hitching post. He wandered dripping through the high rooms with their ruined plaster, the buckled wainscot, the wallpaper hanging in great deciduous fronds, small mounds of human stool with stained shreds of newsprint. From an upper window, he watched the three boys go along the brow of the hill in the rain. Wedges of dry, cracked glazing lay along the broken panes of glass in the floor. Below the window, a mossy courtyard, where old concrete dolphins rusted in a dry fountain, and the dark, hand-kilned bricks of the walkways lay overgrown with moss and lichens. Black ivy crept the garden walls, and small, mute birds peeped out. Across the river, the rainy, hodden landscape, he could see traffic going along the boulevard, locked in another age of which some dread vision had afforded him this lonely cognizance. He emerged from the narrow back stairwell and came up the hall with slow tread over the weather-sprung parquetry, past great doors of solid cherry split open in long fibrous cracks and plundered of their knobs and hardware. Into this drawing room with high plaster frieze and foliate scrollwork, prolapsed and water-stained ceiling, the sagging coffers. He turned, a vain figure in the ruins. Blind parched cherubs watched from the high corners. "Hello," he called, a voice that went from room to room and back again. "Gods and fathers, what has happened here? Good friends, where is their clemency?" One spring morning, timing the lean, near-liquid progress of a horse on a track, the dust exploding, the rapid hasping of his hocks, coming up the straight, foreshortened and a wobble, and passing elongate and bird-like with harsh breath and slatted brisket, heaving and the muscles sliding and bunching in clock-like flexion under the wet black hide and a gout of foam hung from the long jaw, and then gone in a muted hoof-clatter, the aging magistrate snapped his thumb from the keep of the stopwatch he held and palmed it into his waistcoat pocket, and looking at nothing, nor child nor horse, set anent that simple comparison of rotary motions and in the oratory to which he was prone, that they had witnessed a thing against which time would not prevail. He meant a thing to be remembered, but the young apostate by the rail at his elbow had already begun to sicken at the slow seeping of life. He could see the shape of the skull through the old man's flesh, hear sand in the glass, lives running out like something foul, night soil from a cesspipe, a measured dripping in the dark. The clock has run, the horse has run, and which has measured which? He moved along the hall toward the dining room, paint on these old paneled doors crazed and yellowed like old porcelain. Something more than time has passed here, in this banquet hall, scene of old heraldic feasts. Sutry in silent recognition of the somewhat illustrious dead. Large companies seated, a fat macassin to adorn the board. The male bone coupling, rearing white and steaming up from the broken meat. Eyes watch, a malediction for those belated on the road, and now commence. Mad trenchermen in armed sorties above the platters, the clang of steel, the stained and dripping chops, the eyes sidling. Yard dogs and starving palliards contest the scraps among the straw. There is nothing laid to table save meat and water. There is no sound of human speech. Beyond the muted clamor at the board, there is a faint echo of another chase. Far hue and cry and distant horns and hounds in pain with eagerness. The master of the table has looked up. Down Murray Fields another hunt has cried the stag. A shield crashes to the floor and three white birds ascend to the rafters and roost uncertainly. The master wipes his fingers in his hair and is rising says that the feast is done. Outside darkness has begun and the hounds' voices are chimes in the distance that toll seven and cease. They wait for the water bearer to come, but he does not come and does not come. Sutry went out through the kitchen and through the ruined garden to the old road. Reprobate scion of doomed Saxon clans, out of a rainy day dream surmised. Old paint on an old sign said dimly to keep out. Someone must have turned it around because it posted the outer world. He went on anyway. He said that he was only passing through. At night he could hear the sewage gurgling and shuttling along through the pipes hung from the bridge's underbelly overhead. The hum of tires. Faint street light fell beyond the dark palings of sumac and blackberry. He rubbed his stomach and belched in his crepuscular solitude, the lamp at his elbow turned down so that the small flame burned in the glass bell ruby black. He has eaten for his supper an entire chicken boiled in a lard pail, he, and he himself is the bat fowler, who crossed like smoke the dark garden patches above First Creek, something out of the night that drifted bedraped with dead hens down toward the moonlit miasma, whitening the cleft of the glen, the ragged trees that seemed to be breathing cold, crossing this small and wretched estuary by a fallen truck door, and climbing rapidly the far side toward the arches of the viaduct. Sutry came, each day new marvels. They sat in purloined lawn chairs and watched a pigeon ringing down, standing off with backing wings and neck hooked while his pink petty singles reached to grasp the pole, and then, like the dove itself descending, the bird limned in blue flame, and a hot crackle of burnt feathers and the thing pitching backward to fall blackened to the ground in a plume of acrid smoke.
"Jean," Sutry said.
"Slick, ain't it?"
"Jean."
"Yeah?"
"What have you got that pole wired to?" Harrogate pointed.
"Them light wires yonder. What I done? I got me some copper wire and wired it and tied one end to a rock and throwed it."
"Jean."
"Yeah?"
"What the hell do you reckon is going to happen when somebody touches that pole?" Harrogate had not even risen to secure the bird. He sat there squatting in the lawn chair with his arms wrapped around his knees,
smoked odor of his ragged clothes, looking up at the pole and then at Sutri. "Well," he said,
"I'd say it would knock 'em on their ass."
"It would kill them." Harrogate looked mildly speculative.
"You reckon it would?"
he said. Another day, pigs. A whole covey of red shoats, loose from some hillside hog pen, that crossed a clearing in the blackened vines and went on down creek toward the river. Harrogate watched them, and then suddenly sat very erect, looking around.
"If them niggers catches you eating one of their hogs, they will have your ass," he said. "But they got to catch me."
He rose and started down the hill toward the road and toward the creekside jungle where the pigs had gone. As he went, he studied the pens scattered among the trees on the hillside above him, eclectic shelters hammered up out of snuff signs and boards and odds of fencing all hung in plumbless suspension down the bald and rain-gutted slope. He could see no one hunting hogs. When he struck the path along the creek, he could see the tracks of the pigs here and there in the patches of black mire, like the delicately pointed prints of small deer. Coming past a collection of old water heaters, he started them, and they flushed into the wall of ivy with high, raspy snorts. He picked one out and dove after it. It went through a mass of vines and over a mound of broken fruit jars and disappeared with an agonized squall. Harrogate fetched up in a small clearing. He had tilted himself into a locust tree and was bleeding in several places. He could hear the pigs diminishing in the distance. When they came out on the riverbank at the point, they paused to test the air. They started downstream at about the time that Harrogate emerged from the brush, and they checked and swung back along the creek, their noses dishing and their eyes white. They defiled down a gully to the water and bunched and jerked their noses at it and came back. Harrogate was closing on them like a gangly tiptoe spider. They veered with new alarm and snuffled and went on down the point.
"Look here at these pigs, Daddy."
A man rose up from the tall grass where he'd been sitting and put his hand on top of his hat and turned around. The pigs flared like quail. They passed Harrogate, some to the left and some to the right, all screaming, and he looked about and threw himself finally in the general direction of the pigs and landed full length with a grunt. When he came upon them next, they were feeding in a bower of honeysuckle, turning up the black earth and devouring worms and grubs and roots with subdued, hoggish joy. Harrogate watched them through the vines, admiring them for plumpness, salivating slightly. He had resolved upon a rush, the pigs being too wary for stealth. He came headlong through the honeysuckle, his eye on one pig and one pig only. They squealed and went rocketing away through the underbrush, his the fleetest of the pack. In no time they were gone. He stood leaning against a tree, his hand on his chest, panting. He turned around. There was a sustained, muffled screeching coming from behind him. He retraced his steps and crossed the chopped ground of the clearing. Following the sound, he came upon a pig with its head in a bucket. As he approached, it went running. It crashed into a tree and fell back and lay there squealing. He ran to it and seized it by a hind leg. It kicked and peeled back a long flap of hide from his forearm. He dropped it again and tried to push the skin back over the wound.
"God damn," he said.
The pig went on through the bushes. He could hear it caroming about, the bucket banging and the pig screeching. He plunged after it. It ran head on into the creek and floundered there in the filthy water with gurgling screams. Harrogate launched out bird-like and fell upon the shoat with an enormous splash. He came bedraggled and wet and filthy up through the woods, dragging the pig by the hind legs, casting about for something to knock it in the head with. He finally selected a stick and laid the pig down, pinning the rear feet to the ground with one hand. He began to beat the back of the pig's head, what of it showed, above the bucket rim, knocking the bale off, denting in the bucket, raising bloody wheels along the pig's neck, and the pig shrieking until finally the stick broke and he flung it away. The pig gave a great jerk, and he fell upon it to hold it down.
"Shit a'mighty," he said.
He came up with the pig holding it about the waist, the bucket against the side of his face, and blood running all down the front of him, hugging it while it kicked and shat. Coming up the creek, walking spraddle-legged and half-staggering, until finally he must stop to rest. He and the pig sitting in a copse of kudzu, quietly getting their strength back like a pair of spent degenerates. Every time the pig squirmed, Harrogate would call down into the bucket for it to quit. His arms were getting tired, and the one that had been peeled was hurting. He struggled up again with the pig and got as far as the garden of water heaters when his eye fell on a piece of pipe lying naked and unattached upon the ground. He picked it up and hefted it, the pig sagging in his arm, its forefeet sticking out. He laid the pig down, kneeling on it until he could get both hind feet in a good grip, and then he raised the pipe and swung with all his strength. Blood spewed from under the edge of the bucket. The pig screamed and gave a mighty surge and began to run sideways in a circle, dragging through the black leaves and rubbish. Harrogate swung again. The bucket went skittering off, and the pig's fear-crazed eye looked up at him. A whitish matter was seeping from its head, and one ear hung down half off. He brought the pipe down again over its skull, starting the eye from its socket. The pig had not stopped screaming.
"Die, goddamn you!"
panted Harrogate, swinging the pipe. The pig humped and stiffened. He bashed it again, spattering brains over the ground. It stretched out, trembled, and quit. Harrogate stood over his victim with a heaving chest and cursed it. He pitched the pipe away and hefted the pig by its hind legs and got it over his shoulder, its bloody head flopping, the brains bulging soft and wet from one side of its broken skull. He labored up to the edge of the road and laid the pig in the dusty bushes and rested. Before starting across the road, he checked to see that no one was about. Strange urchin dragging a dead pig, a trail of blood. Twigs, small stones, clung to the clot of brains. He dragged it up the path and under the viaduct and laid it out on the cool earth and sat looking at it. He honed his shoplifted pocket knife on a small stone and knelt down by the dead pig and took it by one leg and held it so for a minute and then let the leg go. He squatted on his heels and flipped the knife into the dirt two or three times, his forehead wrinkled. Finally, he raised the pig's leg and stuck the blade into the pig's stomach. Then he had another thought and seized one ear and rested the head up and hacked open the throat. Blood poured out and ran over the dirt. Now he sliced the pig open and hauled forth the guts, great armloads of them. He'd never seen so many. What to do with them? He lugged them down the path and flung them into the bushes and came back. As he had no way of scalding the pig, he had decided upon skinning it. When the owner of the pig arrived, he found a scrawny and blood-covered white boy-child standing on what was left of his property, sawing at it with a knife and hauling on the skin and cursing. The dirty, half-flayed pig looked like something recovered from a shallow grave. He was a black of a contemplative nature, and he was just slightly drunk, and he stood leaning there against the abutment of the viaduct and took a sip from a half-pint bottle and slipped it back into his hip pocket and wiped his mouth and watched this spectacle of frenzied mayhem with a troubled gaze.
"Ah!"
said Harrogate when he glimpsed him leaning there. The owner nodded his head.
"Mm-hmm,"
he said.
"Hattie."
He turned his head and spat and regarded Harrogate with one eye slightly veiled.
"You ain't seed a stray shoat abouts, have you?"
"A what?"
"Little old hog. A young, young hog."
Harrogate tittered nervously.
"Hog?"
he said in a high voice.
"Hog."
"Well, I got this one here."
He pointed at it with the knife. The black craned his head to peer.
"Oh," he said. "I thought that was somebody."
"Somebody?"
"Yes. You say that's a hog?"
"Yes," said Harrogate. "It's a hog."
"You wouldn't care for me to look at it, would you?"
"No, no, no."
He gestured at it.
"Go ahead."
The black man came forward and bent and studied the pig's ruined head. He took hold of the tip of the ear and turned it slightly.
"This hog's dead," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"I swear if it don't look almost exactly like the one I had up at my place."
"It was just sort of running around."
"What was your plans for this here hog, if you don't care for my asking?"
"Well, I'd sort of figured on eating it."
"Did you mean to say it was yourn?" if I'm not mistook.
Well, put fire. If it's yourn, why then just go on and take it.
The owner was looking about the little camp for the first time.
You live here? He said.
Yes, sir.
I see lights over here the night.
I generally keep a lantern going.
I guess it's cold in under here, in the winter.
Well, I ain't been here in the winter yet.
I see.
You say you live up on a hill yonder?
Yes. You can see my place from just out here.
Boy, I like it down here, don't you? I mean, you're close to town and all, and they don't nobody bother you.
The owner looked at Harrogate, and he looked at the pig.
Boy, he said, what do you reckon I'm going to do with that there mass?
I don't know, said Harrogate in a quick, nervous voice.
Well, you better think of something.
I'd take it if you didn't want it.
Take it?
Yes, sir.
Is you prepared to compensate me for that there hog?
Do what?
Pay me.
Pay you?
Now you got it right.
Harrogate was still standing astraddle the deceased animal, and now he unstood himself from over it and wiped his bloody hands down the side of his trouser legs and looked up at the owner.
How much?
He said.
$10.
$10?
It'd have brung every cent of it.
I ain't got no $10.
Then I reckon you'll have to work it out.
Work it out?
Work. It's how most folks gets their living. Them what ain't prowling other folks' hog pens.
What if I don't?
I'll law you.
Oh.
You can start in the morning.
What do you want me to do with this?
The owner had already started out through the weeds. He turned and looked back at Harrogate and at the hog.
You can do whatever you want with it, he said. It's yourn.
How do I find you up yonder?
You asked for Rufus Wiley. You'll find me.
How much hour do I get to work it out at?
Harrogate was fairly shouting across the space between them there under the viaduct, although Rufus was not yet 30 feet away.
50 cents an hour.
I'll take 75,
called Harrogate. But Rufus didn't even answer this. All that night, cats moaned in the dark like cats in rut and circled and spat. Lean dogs came from the weeds, high-hackled and tail-tucked, with their lips crimped and teeth bright red in the light of the road lanterns. Beyond in the dark, where the guts lay, they circled and snapped and glided in like sharks. He lay by a dying fire in the creeping damp and listened to the snarling and rending out there, until some hour toward dawn, when these windfall innards had been divided and consumed, and even the most brazen cur had decided not to risk the red hell of lanterns surrounding Harrogate's hog where it hung. The spoilers all slunk away to silence, one by one, and only a thin cat squall came back, far, now farther, from the hill beyond the creek. When Harrogate went down the little path toward the hog lot, lugging the pail of slops before him in two hands, all the small pigs had been returned to the pen, and they greeted him with squeals and snorts, jostling along the fence, their pale, hammer-shaped snouts working in the mesh. He looked back over his shoulder toward the house and then fetched the nearest a good kick in the head. He poured the curdled, stinking mess down a rough board chute and stepped back. The pigs grunted and shoved and slurped at the swill, and Harrogate shook his head. In the adjoining pen, the sow lay sleeping in mud. He moved along the fence and bent to study her. Striped lice the size of lizards traversed the pink, nigh hairless swine's hide. He picked up a piece of coal and threw it, and it made a dull thump against the fat barrel of her bulk. Her ears twitched, and she raised up and snuffed about. The chunk of coal lay just behind her foreleg, and she found it and set to eating it, grinding it up with great crunching sounds, a black drool swinging from her jowls. When it was gone, she looked up at Harrogate to see if there were more. Harrogate pursed his lips and spat between her eyes, but she seemed not to notice.
You're crazier than shit, he said.
The hog tested the air with her snout, and Harrogate turned and went back to the house.
"Don't set that bucket in here," she said. "This ain't no hog pen."
Harrogate gave her a malignant look and went back out again.
"When's dinner?"
he said, his face at the screen door.
"When it's done."
"Shit," he said.
"What you say?"
"Nothing.
I hear him say for you to cut some wood."
Harrogate spat and made his way across the small, scrabbled lot to the woodpile. Pullets trotted off before him, a patchy band of birds in molt, small leprous fowl that scuttered across the mud with bald pin-shaft rumps. He picked up a hand axe used for splitting kindling and set about chopping ants in two as they crossed a pine log.
"Niggers," he said. "Shit."
On the other hand, he was eating pretty good. Long after he'd worked out the price of the shoat, he was still around to fetch and carry or lie these last warm days in a den in the honeysuckle and read comic books he'd stolen, risible picture tales of walking green cadavers and drooling ghouls. Next door but one lived a pair of nubile young black girls, and he used to hang from a tree limb outside their window at night in hopes of seeing them undress. Mostly they just stepped out of their cotton dresses and went to bed in their undershifts. He tried to lure the younger one to his bower in the honeysuckle with promises of comic books. She said,
"Me and Marfa come down there directly she gets in."
They came sidling and giggling after supper and carried off his whole supply. Visions of plump young midnight tits, long dusky legs. It was September now, a season of rains. The gray sky above the city washed with darker scud like ink curling in a squid's wake. The blacks can see the boy's fire at night and glimpses of his veering silhouette slotted in the high nave, outsized among the arches. All night a ruby glow suffuses the underbridge from his garish chancel lamps. The city's bridges all patrolled now, what with old ventriloquists and young melon fanciers. The smoke from their fires issues up unseen among the soot and dust of the city's right commerce. Sometimes in the evening, Sutri would bring beers, and they'd sit there under the viaduct and drink them, Harrogate with questions of city life.
"You ever get so drunk you kissed a nigger?"
Sutri looked at him. Harrogate, with one eye narrowed on him to tell the truth.
"I've been a whole lot drunker than that," he said. "Worst thing I ever done was to burn down old Lady Arwood's house."
"You burned down an old lady's house?"
"Like to have burnt her down in it. I was put up to it. I wasn't but 10 year old."
"Not old enough to know what you were doing."
"Yeah. Hell no, that's a lie. I knowed it and done it anyways."
"Did it burn completely down?"
"Plumb to the ground. Left the chimbley standing was all. It burnt for a long time before she come out."
"Did you not know she was in there?"
"I disremember. I don't know what I was thinking. She come out and run to the well and drawed a bucket of water and throwed it at the side of the house, and then just walked on off towards the road. I never got such a whipping in my life. The old man liked to have killed me."
"Your daddy?"
"Yeah, he was alive then. My sister told them deputies when they come out to the house, they come out there to tell her I was in the hospital over them watermelons. She told them I didn't have no daddy was how come I got in trouble. But shitfire, I was mean when I did have one. It didn't make no difference."
"Were you sorry about it? The old lady's house, I mean."
"Sorry I got caught."
Sutri nodded and tilted his beer. It occurred to him that, other than the melon caper, he'd never heard the city rat tell anything but naked truth. In the long windy days of fall, Harrogate joined the blacks to fish for carp at the point, smiling and incompetent. A pale arm among darker waving from the shore to Sutri as he set forth in the cool mornings. Sutri busy caulking up the batboards of his shanty with old newsprint. The cooler days have brought a wistful mood upon him. The smell of coal smoke in the air at night. Old times, dead years. For him, such memories are bitter ones. Tripping through the dew has a muskrat coat bought in a junk shop on Central Avenue, which he has dyed purple. Mother She has come from upcountry with sacks and jars of the season's herbs. Her little yard lies deep with sear brown locust pods. In the trees, small victims struggle, toad or shrewlet among the thorns where they have been impaled, and the shrike who put them there trills from a nearby light wire, and it has begun to rain again. And from his FLIR glass window, the shut-in watches for idle travelers on the path below, gripping the worn oak arms of his wheelchair, wishing all on to a worse hell yet. The ragman hurried home with Dark hard at his heels. When he reached the end of the bridge, the lights went up behind him, and he turned to look back for a moment before he ducked past the railing and down the red clay path to his home. Crouched before his fire, he could see the stars come out in the darkening river. He kneaded his bony hands and watched the shapes flame took among the sticks of wood as if some portent might be read there. He smacked his gums and spat and gestured with his hands. He'd stood off a family of trash pickers in the alley that morning. There, under the deep-walled shadows where the windows were barred and iron fire stairs hung in chains overhead. Setting the dark brick corridor full of voices, aged but spoken with authority. Run them off like rats. And out of there, you, and don't come back. Sutri rose from the rock where he'd been sitting and shook the stiffness from one knee. The old man looked up at him. From under the whites of his eyeballs peeked a rim of the red flame that raged in his head.
You come back and find me dead, he began. Find me laying here dead. You just throw some coal oil on me and set me alight. You hear?
Sutri looked off toward the river and the lights, and then he looked at the ragman again.
You'll outlive me, he said.
No, I won't neither. Will you do it?
Sutri wiped his mouth.
I'll pay you.
Pay me?
What will you take? I'll give you a dollar.
Good God, I don't want a dollar.
What would you have to have?
You wouldn't burn, he gestured with his hands. You wouldn't burn up with just coal oil thrown on you. It'd just make a big stink.
I'll get some by God gasoline, then. I'll get 5 gallon and have it setting here at all times.
They'd send out the fire trucks when they saw that.
I don't give a good shit what they send. Will you?
All right.
You won't take no dollar?
No.
I hold you to your word now.
Whatever's right, said Sutri.
I ain't no infidel. Don't pay no mind to what they say.
No.
I always figured they was a god.
Yes.
I just never did like him.
As he was going up Gay Street, J-Bone stepped from a door and took his arm.
Hey, bud, he said.
How you doing?
I was just started down to see you. Come in and have a cup of coffee.
They sat at the counter at Helms. J-Bone kept tapping his spoon. When the coffee was set before them, he turned to Sutri.
Your old man called me, he said. He wanted you to call home.
People in hell want ice water.
Hell, bud, it might be something important.
Sutri tested the cup rim against his lower lip and blew. Like what? He said.
Well, something in the family, you know. I think you ought to call.
He put the cup down.
All right, he said.
What was it?
Why don't you call him?
Why don't you tell me?
Will you not call?
No. J-Bone was looking at the spoon in his hand. He blew on it and shook his head, the distort image of him upside down in the spoon's bowl misting away and returning.
Well, he said.
Who's dead, Jim? He didn't look up.
Your little boy, he said,
Suttree set his cup down and looked out the window. There was a small pool of spilled cream on the marble countertop at his elbow, and flies were crouched about it, lapping like cats. He got up and went out. It was dark when the train left the station. He tried to sleep, his head rolling about on the musty headrest. There was no longer a club car or dining car. No service anymore. An old black came through with his zinc sandwich tray and drink cooler. He passed down the corridor of the semi-darkened car, crying his wares softly, and disappeared through the door at the far end. A racket of wheels from the roadway and a slip of cool air. The sleepers slept. The sad and dimly lit backside of a town went down the windows. Fence rails, weed lots, barren autumn fields sliding blackly off under the stars. They went across the flatland toward the Cumberlands, the old car rocking down the rails and the pole wires sewing tirelessly the night beyond the cold window glass. He woke in various small mountain towns through the early hours of the morning, old people with baskets laboring up the aisle, black families with sleepy children clumping past, whispering, the rusty coaches wheezing and steaming, and then the slow accumulate creaking and grating of iron as they pulled out again. It had grown cold in the night, but he was numb with other weathers. An equinox in the heart. Ill change. Unluck. Suttree held his face in his hands. Child of darkness and familiar of small dooms. He himself used to wake in terror to find whole congregations of the uninvited attending his bed, protean figures slouched among the room's dark corners in all multiplicity of shapes. Gibbons and gargoyles, arachnoids of outrageous size, a bat-shaped creature hung by some cunning in a high corner from whence clicked and winked like bone chimes its incandescent teeth. In the cold autumn dawn that crept the fields, he woke and watched the passing countryside through the glass. Light rain or mist, small beads of water racing on the pane. They crossed a creek by an old trestle, black creosoted timbers flicking past. On the gray water, two boys in a skiff, motionless, watching the faces pass like a film strip above them. One raised a hand, a solemn gesture. In the distance, smoking millstacks arranged upon a gray and barren plain. Somewhere beyond them, the cold rain falling in a new-dug grave. The train lurched and rumbled, went pounding down a long levee with marsh and swampland smoking in the bluish light, a white egret, one-legged and livid in the water, quartered to a darker antipode, and rigid as a plaster lawn bird. Stark woods beyond, a few leaves falling. Suttree wiped his eyes with his shoulders and rose and went down the aisle past the stale and empty seats. He stood between cars, the upper half of the door latched back, and the cool morning wind blowing in, leaning with his elbows propped, the car rocking and swaying as they came into the yards. Staccato lights tracking in the gray freeze out there. In an upper window, a man in his undershirt with his braces hanging. Across the narrow space, he and Suttree looked at each other for just a moment before he was snapped away. The gray steel trusses of a bridge went past, went past, went past. In the sidelong morning light, he saw the shadowed half-shapes of auto shells crouched in dying ivy down a long and barren gut. In the station, Suttree stood bending to deal with a small man in a cage, polished blue suit, a lapel badge.
10 o'clock, the man said.
He nodded.
There's no other transportation out there, I don't guess.
The little man was stamping long rolls of ticket. He punched his lower lip and shook his head. Thanks.
Unless you wanted to take a cab. Costs right smart.
Thanks, Suttree said. He found a crystal near the bus station and had scrambled eggs and toast, and he looked through the newspaper but could see no news for him. At 10 o'clock, he boarded the bus and leaned back and closed his eyes. Remorse lodged in his gorge like a great salt cinder. What will she say? What will her mother say? her father. Sutry got up and swung down toward the door, but the bus had already started. He hung by one hand, swaying. All night he'd tried to see the child's face in his mind, but he could not. All he could remember was the tiny hand in his as they went to the carnival fair, and a fleeting image of Elf's eyes, wonderstruck at the wide world and its wheeling. Where a Ferris wheel swung in the night and painted girls were dancing, and skyrockets went aloft and broke to shed a harlequin light above the fairgrounds and the upturned faces. They watched him from the porch, gathered there like a sitting for some old sepia tintype, the mother's hand on the seated patriarch's shoulder. Watched him coming up the walk with his empty hands and burnt-looking eyes. Sutri's abandoned wife. She came down the steps slowly, Madonna bereaved, so grief-stunned, and wooden pieta of perpetual dawn. The birds were hushed in the presence of this gravity, and the derelict that she had taken for the son of light himself was consumed in shame like a torch. She touched him as a blind person might, deep in the floor of her welling eyes, dead leaves scudding. "Please go away," she said. "When is the funeral?"
3:00. "Please, buddy."
"I won't."
"Don't say anything, please. I can't bear it."
By now the mother had come from the porch. She was dressed in black and closed upon them, soundless as a plague, her bitter, twisted face looming, axe mark for a mouth, and eyes crazed with hatred. She tried to speak, but only a half-strangled scream came out. The girl was thrown aside, and this demented harridan was at him clawing, kicking, gurgling with rage. The girl tried to pull her away.
"Mother,"
she wailed.
"Mother!"
The old lady had gotten Sutri's finger in her mouth and was gnawing on it like a famished ghoul. He seized her by the throat. The three of them went to the ground. Sutri could feel something thudding at the base of his skull. The old man had come from the porch and was hitting him with his shoe. He tried to get to his feet. The girl was screaming.
"Stop it, you all! Oh, God, stop it!"
"Get the police, Leon," screamed the old lady. "I'll hold him."
Sutri staggered erect in the midst of this sorry spectacle, groaning like a bear. The old man had fallen back. The girl was pulling at the old lady, but she was hanging on to his leg with a maniac's strength, and gibbering the while.
"You ghastly bitch,"
he said, and fetched her a kick in the side of the head, which stretched her out. With this, the girl fell upon him in much the same manner. He flung her back and tottered away a few steps to get his breath. The old man was coming from the house, loading a shotgun as he ran. Sutri vaulted through the hedge. He crossed a lawn and went through another hedge and down a small lane past some chickens in a foul-smelling pen, the birds flaring and squawking, Sutri crossing through another yard and coming out alongside a house where a man in a lawn chair looked up from the nothing he was contemplating and smiled curiously. Sutri nodded to him and went on down the drive into the road. He looked back, but no one was coming. He walked on out to the highway and squatted by the side of the road to rest, and when a car came down the pike, he rose to flag it with his thumb. In a few minutes, another car came along, and this one stopped. Sutri climbed in and said hello. The man looked at him once or twice with alarm. Sutri looked down at himself. The front of his shirt was ripped open, and his left hand was covered with blood. He zipped up his jacket, and they rode on in silence. A small town in the flatlands. He had been here once, but remembered it little. A fresh breeze was herding leaves along the walkways, and little shop signs swung and creaked in the smoky air. He pointed toward the curb, and the man pulled over to let him out. "Much obliged," the man nodding. Sutri could see him looking over the seat for bloodstains as he pulled away. He went to the pool hall and washed up and looked at his hand. 4 bright slashes on his jaw. He plucked small bits of harrowed flesh from the edges of the wounds and daubed at them with a wet paper towel. The face in the mirror that watched was gray and the eyes sunken. He put on his jacket and went to the front counter and asked to use the telephone. The man nodded toward it. There was a directory hanging from a chain. He opened to the back and found two listings under funeral parlors, dialed the first, and spoke with a soft-voiced girl. Are you people in charge of the Suttree funeral?
Yes, sir. That's at 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Suttree didn't hear. The words, Suttree funeral, had caused him to let the receiver fall away from his ear.
Hello?
Said the girl. Yes, said Suttree. Where is the burial to be?
At McCammon Cemetery.
Where is that? The girl didn't answer for a moment. Then she said,
The cortege will be going directly to the cemetery after the services. If you care to join, or if you...
Thank you, Suttree said. But if you could just give me directions. He walked about in the town, peaceful and sunny in the mid-Americas on an autumn day. The dread in his heart was a thing he'd not felt since he feared his father in the aftermath of some child's transgression. He ate a sandwich in the drugstore, and in the afternoon he started out toward the cemetery, along a little country road where leaves lay in yellow windrows through the woods or tumbled over the dark macadam. It was an hour's walk, and few cars passed. Two stonework columns marked the entrance, the chain down and heaped in the grass. He went down the little gravel road among the stones until he saw on a hill a green canopy. Two men were sitting in the grass eating their lunch. Suttree nodded to them as he passed. Beneath the canopy were folding chairs in rows, a green canvas mound with flowers arranged. He could not bring himself to ask if this were the place where his dead son was going, and he walked on. If there were other burials in preparation, he would see them. In an older part of the cemetery, he saw some people strolling. Elderly gent with a cane, his wife on his arm. They did not see him. They went on among the tilted stones and rough grass, the wind coming from the woods cold in the sunlight. A stone angel in her weathered marble robes, the downcast eyes. The old people's voices drift across the lonely space, murmurous above these places of the dead. The lichens on the crumbling stones like a strange green light. The voices fade. Beyond, the gentle clash of weeds. He sees them stoop to read some quaint inscription, and he pauses by an old vault that a tree has half dismantled with its growing. Inside, there is nothing. No bones, no dust. How surely are the dead beyond death? Death is what the living carry with them. A state of dread, like some uncanny foretaste of a bitter memory. But the dead do not remember, and nothingness is not a curse. Far from it. He sat in the dappled light among the stones. A bird sang. Some leaves were falling. He sat with his hands palm up on the grass beside him like a stricken puppet. And he thought no thoughts at all. In mid-afternoon, an old Packard hearse came wending through the woods, leading a few cars, and circled the canopy on the hill and parked on the far side. The cars came quietly to rest, and people in black emerged. Steel doors dropped shut softly, one by one. The mourners moved graveward. Four pallbearers lifted the small coffin from the funeral car and carried it to the tent. Suttree came up over the hill in time to see it go. Some flowers fell. He walked up the hill above the gravesite and stood numbly. The little bier with its floral offerings had come to rest on a pair of straps across the mouth of the grave. A preacher stood at the ready. The light in this little glade where they stood seemed suffused with immense clarity, and the figures appeared to burn. Suttree stood by a tree, but no one noticed him. The preacher had begun. Suttree heard no word of what he said until his own name was spoken. Then everything became quite clear. He turned and laid his head against the tree, choked with a sorrow he had never known. When all the words were done, a few stepped forth and placed a flower, and the straps began to lower, the casket and child sinking into the grave. A group of strangers commending Sutri's son to Earth. The mother cried out and sank to the ground, and was lifted up and helped away wailing. Stabat Mater Dolorosa. Remember her hair in the morning before it was pinned, black, rampant, savage with loveliness, as if she slept in perpetual storm. Sutri went to his knees in the grass, his hands cupped over his ears. Someone touched his shoulder. When he looked up, there was no one there. The last of the motorcade was moving down the little drive toward the gate, and save the two sextons, crouched in the hillside grass like jackals, he was alone. He rose and went down to the grave. There, among flowers and the perfume of the departed ladies and the faint iron smell of the earth, to stand looking down into a full-size 6-foot grave with this small box resting in the bottom of it. Pale man-child, were their last agonies? Were you in terror? Did you know? Could you feel the claw that claimed you? And who is this fool kneeling over your bones, choked with bitterness? And what could a child know of the darkness of God's plan, or how flesh is so frail it is hardly more than a dream? When he looked up, the gravediggers were watching him from the side of the hill. He called to them, but they did not answer, thinking him mad with grief, perhaps. Perhaps he addressed his God. You two! Hey! They looked at each other, and after a time rose slowly, and came shambling down across the green like ordinaries in a Teutonic drama. Sutri was sitting in one of the folding chairs. He gestured loosely at the grave. Can you fill this in now? They looked at each other, and then one of them folded his arms and looked down. Orville's coming with the tractor, he said. We was just supposed to fold these here chairs and stack 'em, the other said. They got to come out and take the tent down. Sutri stared at them. The one with his arms crossed began to rock up and down on his heels and look about. Orville and them be here directly, the other one said. Sutri rose from the chair and pulled back the canvas drop where it was thrown over the mound of earth. A few racks of flowers toppled. A pick and two spades lay there, and he took up one of the spades and sank it into the loose dirt and hefted it and sent a load of clods rattling over the little coffin. The two men looked at each other. We got to get them straps, the one said. You better get 'em, then, said Sutri, swinging a spade load of clay. Well, hold up a minute. The smaller man stepped down into the grave to free the straps, and the other one hauled them up. You want this here wreath? Said the man in the grave, raising up, just his head sticking out. He shook it. It's got dirty, he said. Get out of there, said Sutri. He climbed out and stood back. Orville and them will be here in a minute, he said. Sutri didn't answer. He labored on, shoveling the dirt, the two men watching. After a while, they began to stir about, folding shut the chairs and stacking them against the corner pole of the canopy. Sutri stopped and took off his jacket and then bent to work again. Before the grave was half-filled, a truck entered the cemetery gates, towing a lowboy with a tractor chained to the bed. The tractor was rigged with a front-loader. They came up the hill and swung down alongside the tent. The driver of the truck looked down at Sutri, his chin on his arm. He spat and looked out over the cemetery grounds and opened the door and climbed down. I lied you'd have this thing down, he called out. Sutri looked. The other two men were smoking and grinning and shuffling their feet. The three of them looked over at him. He shoveled on. The driver and the lowboy climbed out, and the four of them stood around talking and smoking. I don't know, one of them said. He just jumped up and went to shoveling. I reckon he was. I don't know. No, he was setting up here on the side of the hill. Hey! Called one of the new men. Sutri looked up. We got a tractor here to do that with, if you want to wait a minute. Sutray wiped his brow with the back of his sleeve and kept on shoveling. The men trod out their cigarettes in the grass and set about uncleating ropes, gouging stakes from the ground. They hauled down the canopy and folded it out on the ground, and Sutray worked on in the open air. They disjointed the pipework frame and loaded poles and ropes and canvas in the truck and passed the folded chairs in after.
"We might as well leave the tractor on the float," one of the men said. "We're going to do them sods in the morning?"
"We'll have to. It's done past quitting time now."
They sat in the grass watching him. Already it was evening and overcast, and before he was done, a small rain came cold and slowly falling out of the south autumn sky. Sutray pitched a final shovelful of clods over the little mound and dropped the spade and picked up his jacket and turned to go.
"You can ride in with us if you want," one of the men said.
He looked up. They were squatting in the rear of the truck, watching the rain. He went on. Before he reached the cemetery gates, a gray car with a gold escutcheon on the door came down the little gravel road and stopped alongside him. A paunchy man in tan gabardines looked up at him.
"Your name, Sutray?"
Sutray said it was. The man climbed out of the car. He wore a tooled belt and holster, and his clothes were neatly pressed. He opened the rear door of the car.
"Get in," he said.
Sutray climbed into the back of the car, and the door shut after him. There was a heavy screen mesh separating him from the front seat, as if the car were used for hauling mad dogs about. There were no door handles or window cranks. The driver looked at him in the mirror, and the man in the gabardines looked straight ahead. Sutray leaned back and passed his hand over his eyes. As they came into town, people watched him from the street.
"Pull over here, Pinky," the man said.
They came to a stop at the curb.
"Go get yourself a Coke."
"I'm all right."
"Go get yourself a Coke."
The driver looked back at Sutray and climbed out and shut the door. The sheriff leaned one arm across the back of the seat and regarded Sutray through the wire. Then he climbed out and opened the back door.
"Get up here," he said.
Sutray climbed out and got into the front of the car. The sheriff walked around and climbed into the driver's seat. He studied Sutray for a minute, and then he said,
"Let me tell you something."
"All right," said Sutray. He reached down and tapped Sutray's knee with his forefinger.
"You, my good buddy, are a 14-carat gold-plated son of a bitch. That's what your problem is. And that being your problem, there's not a whole lot of people in sympathy with you, or with your problem. Now I'm going to do you a favor, against my better judgment, and it's not going to make me no friends. I'm going to drive your stinking ass to the bus station and give you an opportunity to get out of here."
"I don't have any money."
"I never reckoned that you did. I intend to put up $5 cash money out of my own pocket to get you started. I ain't interested in where you go, but I aim to see to it that you go $5 worth in some direction, and you and me both are going to hope that you don't never come back. Now, do you want to know why?"
"Why what?"
"Why I'm putting up the $5.
"No."
"I thought maybe the economics of it might interest you. I hear tell you're supposed to be real smart."
"I don't care."
"The reason I'm investing $5 in your absence is because the man whose daughter's life you ruined happens to be a friend of mine, and a man I not only like but respect. And I'd like to see him have some peace of mind. I know he ain't going to thank me for this. What he'd like is to see you hung. But I know him for a fair-minded man and a peace-loving man. And I know that he'll be happier in his mind if he just gets you out of his sight. He might even come to forget there ever was a low-life like you, although I doubt it."
"What do you get out of it?"
"Not a thing, good buddy."
"You said I ought to be interested in the economics of it."
"I said it, but I don't believe it. It's not much economics anyway. About the only thing to be said for getting fucked out of $5 this way is that you won't catch the clap."
I never expected you to understand. No one cares. It's not important. That's where you're wrong, my friend. Everything's important. A man lives his life, he has to make that important. Whether he's a small-town county sheriff or the president. Or a busted-out bum. You might even understand that someday. I don't say you will. You might. The sheriff turned in the seat and reached for the key and turned it. But the motor was already running and the starter made a sudden wild screeching sound. He muttered to himself and shifted the gears, and they went on down the street. The bus station was in the back of a cafe, and when they pulled up in front, there were two buses idling in the alley. The sheriff shifted and took out his billfold and lifted a $5 bill from it and handed it across. I suppose I have to take it, Suttree said. You suppose correctly. Suttree took the bill and looked at it. Now, the sheriff said, I want you to take whichever bus out of here best pleases you, and I want you to ride $5 in that direction, and I don't want you back. You got that?
I've got it. Suttree was holding the money in his hand. The sheriff looked at him.
You all right? He said.
Yeah, I'm all right.
I'm puzzled that you'd have the face to come here.
Well, you're puzzled.
I will say one thing. You've opened my eyes. I've got two daughters, oldest 14. And I'd see them both in hell before I'd send them up to that university. I'm damned if I wouldn't.
How many sons have you got?
Not any. Look, Suttree, I'm sorry as far as that goes. These people did want me to put you in jail.
I know.
Well, you get your ticket right in there. Don't let me see you on the street. You stay in there till your bus runs, you hear?
Suttree opened the door and climbed out. He looked down at the sheriff, and then he shut the door.
You take care, the sheriff said.
Okay. The sheriff had bent forward to see his face. Suttree turned and walked into the cafe. He left the bus in Stanton, Tennessee, with $3 still in his pocket. It was 10 o'clock at night. He walked down to a cab stand and bought a pint of whiskey from a driver and put it in his shirt and hiked out to the edge of town and stood in the road holding his thumb up at the lights that passed. None stopped. After an hour, he walked on. It had turned cool. He could see lights far up the highway, a roadhouse or cafe. The sign said it was a truck stop, and there was a diesel rig pulled over on the gravel with the motor running. Suttree peered in through the plate glass window. A cold hall of a place, plastic tables, two boys playing a pinball machine. The driver sat at the counter drinking coffee. Suttree searched his pockets for a dime, but he had none. He went in anyway. An ancient waitress was cleaning out the coffee urn with a short-handled mop. When she saw Suttree, she climbed down off the chair she was standing on and came shuffling up the aisle behind the counter. Suttree leaned on the counter next to the driver. The driver looked at him.
Is that your rig? Said Suttree.
The driver set his cup down.
Yeah, he said, that's my rig.
You reckon I could get a ride with you?
Where you going?
To Knoxville.
I ain't going to Knoxville.
Well, where are you going?
I ain't going to Knoxville.
The driver bent and sipped his coffee, and Suttree stood looking down at him, and then turned and left the cafe. He started back down the highway toward the town. The lights had dimmed. The town seemed farther at this midnight hour. Partway down the road, he stopped and opened the bottle and drank. The first building he came to was a church. There was a small illuminated glass case standing in the yard, white letters on a black plastic board within. Insects were swarming over the dimly lit church news. Suttree turned across the lawn and went to the back of the church and sat in the grass and drank the whiskey. After he had drunk a little of it, he began to cry. He began to cry harder and harder until he was sitting there in the grass with the bottle upright between his knees, wailing aloud. He must have slept. When he woke, he was lying in the grass looking up at the heavens. A cloudless night strewn with stars. Salt taste of sorrow in his throat. He saw a star spill across the sky, a light trail of fire, and then nothing. Hot spalls of matter rifling through the icy ether. Misshapen globs of iron slag. The night had grown much colder. He lay in the grass shivering, and he tried to sleep, but he could not. After a while, he rose and took the whiskey and went to the rear door of the church and tried it, and it opened. He was in a cellar. There were stacks of old newspapers and magazines along one wall, and he stretched out on these and lay there. Then he sat up and took some to spread over him and lay down again. Then he started to cry again, lying there in the dark of the church cellar under the old newspapers. It was mid-morning when he woke. A truck gone out the pike had rattled the cellar door. He sat up in a flurry of newsprint and looked about. Light fell from a high window. Some kind of small bird was pecking in the grass there. Sutri rose and ran his hand through his hair. His throat was dry and his head hurt. The rest of the whiskey stood in the bottle on the floor, and he fetched it up and held it to the light. It was about a third full, and he unscrewed the cap and took a drink and shuddered and shook himself, and then took another drink. Then he went out. It took him all day to cross the state. He was unshaven, and he looked bad. Toward evening, he was in a nameless crossroads high in the Cumberland Mountains. A quarter mile down the road, in the dusk, stood a figure like his own, a wanderer long mirrored in the black asphalt, one arm aloft. Sutri walked on. It was a husky young boy, and he had stationed himself in front of a small country store to try for a ride. Sutri walked on past. The store was closed, and the windows boarded up, and some twisted pipes grew from the concrete apron in front where a gas pump had been ripped up. "Hey," the boy said. "Hey," said Sutri. "You live around here?" "No." "You ain't got a cigarette on you, have you?" The boy was walking down toward him, studying him with a kind of sly intensity that drifters seem to come by. "No," Sutri said. "I saw you thumbing down there. Where you headed?" "Knoxville." "I'm going to Florida. I got a sister in Fort Lauderdale." He turned and spat. He had on a short-sleeved shirt, and Sutri in his jacket was already cold. Dark as it was, he could see him but poorly. Tattoos along one arm. "I'll go on down," said Sutri. The boy changed his tone. "Listen," he said. "Why don't we hitch together? We might have a better chance." Sutri looked at him. He was dressed in jeans, and his hair was wild, and he wore a general look of dangerous filth. A big, mean-looking kid. "I'll go on down," said Sutri. "Let you have first shot." "You reckon anybody might stop along here after dark?" "I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine." "Yeah?" "Where did you come from?" The kid's eyes shifted. "St. Louis," he said. "St. Louis," said Sutri. "I've been through there." "Ain't this a hell of a place to get stuck?" "Yeah. Good luck." "Listen, how far is it to the next town?"
"I don't know."
Sutri had started off.
"Listen,"
the kid called again.
"What?" "You got a quarter you could let me have?"
Sutri shook his head no. The kid was walking down toward him.
"Come on, man," he said. "I ain't eaten 2 goddamn days. Hell, 15 cents, something."
"I ain't got a dime," Sutri said.
"Let's see."
Sutri watched him. He was standing on the balls of his feet, and he looked hungry.
"What?" he said. "I said, let's see. Let's see you turn your pockets out."
"I told you I'm not holding anything." The kid moved slightly to his left.
"That's what you say," he said. "I'd like to see."
"That's your problem," Sutri said. He stepped back and turned to go. As he did so, the kid jumped him. Sutri ducked. They went to the ground together. Sutri could smell the stale sweat of him. The kid was trying to hit him, short chops with his big fists. Sutri pushed his face against his chest. Fear and nausea. The kid quit punching and tried to get him by the throat. Sutri rolled. They came up. The kid had hold of his jacket. Sutri swung at him. They closed, feet scrabbling in the gravel there in the near dark in front of the abandoned store. The kid turned loose of Sutri to hit him, and Sutri dropped to one knee and seized the kid behind the cabs and pulled him down hard on his rump. Then he was running down the highway, the kid's shoes slapping after him, taste of blood in his mouth. But the footsteps faded, and when Sutri looked back, he could see in the deeper dusk by the roadside the kid crouched to get his breath.
"You yellow cocksucker!"
the voice came drifting up the highway. Sutri put his hand to his heart, where it boomed in the otherwise silence of the wilderness. He went on up the road in the dark. It is little more than dawn when the general comes down Front Street, slumped on the box of his coal wagon, the horse named Golgotha hung between the trees and stumbling along in the cold with his double-jointed knees and his feet clopping, and the bright, worn quoits winking feebly among the clattering spokes. In the whip socket rides a bent cane. There is a gap in the iron of one tire, and above the meaningless grumbling of the wagon, it clicks, clicks, with a clock-like persistence that tolls progress, purpose, the passage of time. When they stop, it is in a violent shudder, as if something has given way. The general climbs and climbs down from his seat, and goes to the rear and takes up his blackened basket and sets it in the street. He levers up the lantern glass and blows out the tiny flame. He hands down coal lump by lump until the basket is filled, and with pain he hefts and carries it toward the dim house, through the chill fog, bent and muttering, returning lightened but with no better speed or humor to where the horse stands sleeping in the traces. They come trundling and slowly a clatter up the empty street, pass under the bridge, and take the bitter and frozen fields toward the river. In the hoar-colored dawn, they seem to be drifting, closed away in the cold smoke until just the general's shoulders and the slouched back of him, with his hat perched on the shoulders of his clothes, and the hat the horse wore, float over the cold gray void like transient artifacts from a polar dream.
"Ooh, coal, kindling wood, wood if I could, help me get sold, coal now."
It was 6 degrees above zero. Sutri crawled from his bed, pulled on his coat and got his trousers, and climbed up onto the bed to don them so cold the floor was. He squatted and fished his socks out from beneath the cot and shook out the dust and pulled them on, and stepped into his shoes and went to the door. Mist swirled about him. The old black coal peddler sat his cart. The horse sidled and stamped.
"Couldn't you just leave a basket and go on?" "I see you ain't froze," said the general, climbing down.
Sutri got the basket from beside the door and came down the walk. The river was frozen between the houseboat and the bank, a thin skim of wrinkled ice through which fell chunks of frozen mud from the underside of the flexing plank. He threw the empty basket up on the wagon and took the full one from the old man.
"I gots to have me some money today," the general said.
"How much?"
"You owes me 85 cents.
"How do you know?" The old man patted his gloved hands together. His head was wrapped in rags.
"I keeps it all in my counts," he said. "You keep your own, if and you don't like mine."
"Where do you keep them?"
"That's all right where I keeps them."
"How much will you take?"
"What all I can get, I reckon."
Sutri set the basket on the frozen ground and reached in his trouser pocket. He had 35 cents. He gave it to the old man, and the old man looked at it a minute and nodded and pulled a cord that went down into his clothing. A long gray sock appeared. The top of it had been fitted with an old brass purse catch, and he unsnapped it and dropped in the coins and lowered it back where it had come from and climbed up onto the wagon box.